I call the meeting of the House Environment Finance Division to order. I'm not sure, I don't think we have a quorum present yet. So we're going to wait on the minutes. If we could have Board of Water and Soil Resources be prepared to speak. Okay, a quorum is present. Representative Eklund, have you reviewed the minutes for the 14th? Let's do them one at a time. Representative Eklund?
Yes, I've reviewed the minutes, Mr. Chair, and I'll move the minutes.
Representative Eklund moves the minutes for February 14th. Any discussion? Any discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Minutes for the 14th are adopted. The 15th, Representative Eklund?
I will also move the minutes for the 15th.
We're on a roll here. Any discussion? Representative Eklund moves the minutes for the 15th. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, nay. Ayes have it. Minutes are adopted. Ms. Becker-Kadelka.
Mr. Chair and members, Angie Becker-Kadelka, Assistant Director with the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources. Thank you for the invitation to do an agency overview. So the Board of Water and Soil Resources mission is to improve and protect Minnesota's water and soil resources by working in partnership with local organizations and private landowners. So our business model is about working on private lands, not public lands. And so that's our unique niche. Private lands account for around 75% of the state. We are a small agency of conservation professionals because Minnesota's approach to conservation delivery is through a locally led conservation delivery system. That means that our whole business is in the business of collaboration and partnerships for on-the-ground results. Our structure. So the Board of Water and Soil Resources is an executive branch agency, meaning the governor proposes our budget. However, we are not a cabinet-level agency. Instead, the governor appoints our 20-member board, which includes soil and water district board members, county commissioners, watershed districts, and citizens at large. Four state agencies, our sister agencies, plus the University of Minnesota, for a round out of 20 members. Our statutory authorities are mostly housed in Minnesota Statutes 103. We also have some in disaster recovery and the newest one, 114D, the Clean Water Legacy Act. Our budget sources for fiscal year 18 and 19. So while this is not a budget presentation, and we'd be glad to come back, if invited to talk about the budget that just came out. This is the breakdown of our funding for fiscal year 18 and 19. Our biennium is about $180 million. About just over half of that is clean water fund dollars. You'll see outdoor heritage is around 15%, as is our general fund, with LCCMR and bonding rounding it out. So how do we accomplish that mission? First, we look to address state and local resource concerns. Again, this is private land conservation, and so this is looking at private lands where there can be the biggest public benefit to water quality and to soil health. And so it's taking a look at problems and finding solutions that meet the needs of the landowner as well as the community. We accomplish our mission by providing for targeted planning, delivery, implementation, and assessment. And we accomplish our mission with state laws and rules. So some key programs in that area. Our regulatory programs include the Wetland Conservation Act, drainage, and buffers. WACA has, and state and federal law, provide for the protection of wetlands. Minnesota has a no net loss of wetlands in effect, and that means that if you're going to impact a wetland, first you must try to avoid it. If you can't avoid it, then you try to minimize it. And if you can't minimize it, if there's anything left, then you must mitigate it. You must create another wetland somewhere else. This is done in coordinated implementation with local governments, the DNR, and federal agencies like the Army Corps. We also have been working on a 404 assumption study And the we are just right now probably in step C of the alphabet, working forward to see if it makes sense and is feasible for the state to assume assumption of the Clean Water Act federal 404 waters. And so what that means is rather than an applicant having to go through both a state and a federal permit process, it would come together to the state and there would be one permitting process. And finally, with WACA is the Local Roads Wetland Replacement Program. Bowser is required by statute that if a local county or township is adding on to a road or redeveloping a road, any wetlands that they impact, the agency must mitigate. And so you'll see there on the left, if there's an impact there, what our job is to take that and to provide and maybe even bundle them together to provide for more efficient wetland mitigation so that a local road authority isn't trying to do each one on their own. It's to take a look at how can we accomplish this better, faster, cheaper, and that's good for wetlands.
Ms. Becker-Kadoka, Representative Eklund has a question, and I have a bill up across the hall, so I'm going to turn the gavel over. So, Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Kadoka, has Bowser come up with their ideas on whether the state should assume the 404 as far as the study goes?
Mr. Chair and members, the Section 404, right now there has been language that's been proposed to continue the process of working with our federal agencies that are in charge of it. So EPA oversees it, the Army Corps of Engineers implements it. And what we've learned over the last even 6 months tells us that the federal government is now saying that they would not retain as many waters. So it seems like there is reason to keep exploring it. That's really a decision for the legislature to make. However, that language moving forward allows us to keep on that process so the legislature can make that decision with full knowledge.
Representative Eklund.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I guess the question is should we? The New Jersey and Michigan, I believe, right now have, and there's other states that are looking at it. So would Bowser think it would be in the best interest of the state and for whatever we have going on that we have to do wetland issues, delineations or whatever? Mm-hmm. So would it be a good idea in Bowser's mind?
Mm-hmm. Ms. Becker-Kadoka.
Madam Chair, members, Representative Eklund, we will be able to answer that question and provide a recommendation once we have additional information. And so we can't make that recommendation until we know for sure what it's going to be, how many waters the state can retain, how much it's going to cost the state, and all of those different factors to understand. So while we can't make that recommendation right now, that is the process that we're undergoing.
Thank you.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Ms. Kadoka, kind of along the same line, have you gotten any maps from the feds? You know, I think one of the things that was really holding this process up in the past was the fact that Army Corps said that there were only about 10% of the waters in the state of Minnesota that were assumable. And nowadays, with the Trump administration, they basically reversed that, and now it's 90% assumable, roughly speaking. Mm-hmm. Do we have any maps?
Ms. Becker-Kadoka.
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, so that is what we're working on. The letters that the Army Corps has provided us would lead us to believe that that is exactly right, that there's going to be, it went from being about 10% that they would let the state assume to, we think, over 90% that they would let the state assume. We have drawn up those maps and given them to review to see if our assumptions is accurate with them. And so that's where we're at in the process right now. So we need to hear back from them if they agree with our assessment.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for that. I appreciate it. We've been working on this for a long time, and it's been one of the things I've been passionate about. I do have a question on the slide where we talk about a local road wetland replacement program. Mm-hmm. And one of the questions I've asked for a number of years is the definition of an impact. There are several of our county engineers up there and maybe across other parts of the state that contend that the impact that is done to a wetland, in essence, winds up being a temporary impact. But once that impact is determined, now we have to mitigate for that, what we would call a temporary impact, to come back 3 years from now and you don't know that anything that happened to it. But we have to make a permanent adjustment, you might say, mm-hmm. or out of the bank. Is there any movement towards delineating more clearly the difference between a temporary impact and a permanent impact so that we could then mitigate temporary?
Ms. Becker Kudalka.
Madam Chair, Representative, the rules governing our work are part of, they're not part of statute, they're part of rule. And as of right now, we must follow the no net loss of wetlands rule. And so as far as I know, I would have to go back and talk to our wetland experts to understand if there's been any discussion or movement around temporary impacts. But as of right now, the rule directs us to mitigate if there's an impact to a wetland at all. And so that's been part of our process that we've done so far.
Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And people who've been associated or have worked with the wetland replacement program know that the replacement costs are extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. And no one's necessarily trying to get out of doing the wetland mitigation and so forth. But if we could find a way to save money and still retain our wetlands long term, I think we'd be better off in the long run. Mm-hmm.
Madam Chair and Representative, I think that's part of the reason that the local road authorities appreciate this program that requires the state to do it. And you have a really good point about we only should be doing local road wetland replacement if it's efficient for local governments. And if it's not, then the state should get out of that business, right? And so it is cheaper for the state to take a whole bunch of these little impacts that's on the left-hand side of your screen and to create one better wetland, as opposed to having the local government go and try to replace wetlands maybe in the area of a road ditch or someplace where it doesn't make as much of an impact or a benefit. And so you're absolutely right. It only works if it's efficient for everybody.
Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so then to that point, when we talk about wetlands and the costs and so forth, somebody could be doing a project on their land that they bought for $1,000 an acre, maybe building a driveway in or something, and now they're mitigating the costs against 1 acre of wetland impact to the tune of $15,000, $25,000. They just don't match up in my mind. But the other thing that we've talked about for a number of years is up in the Red River Valley, we create impoundment areas where we're holding back water as part of a statewide goal to mitigate peak water flow by 20%. I contend that we should be able to create wetlands inside of these impoundments, and this drum continues to beat. I'm going to keep doing this, and then use those wetlands for mitigating public projects and so forth. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, but are we making any progress towards engineering these and designing these impoundment areas, which are several square miles? The Klondike project, I think, is going to be 12 or 14 square miles. A perfect opportunity to create wetlands for the public bank. Are we making any progress there?
Ms. Becker-Kudalka?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's a great question. The funding source is part of the issue. So if the funding source is a dedicated legacy fund, for example, it needs to be for conservation purposes. And the way that it has been interpreted to the agency thus far is that it cannot be used for mitigation purposes. So this is to accelerate conservation and not for mitigation. However, there are other funding sources, such as bonding, where you can take a look at what might be the multiple benefits. And so there's been a couple of pilot projects up in the Red River Basin where there is more bounce, so there's more water that goes up and down within a season to help with flood control, but also then is taking a look at what might be the late season habitat impacts and benefits.
One last question. Thank you, Madam Chair. So one last thing. Mm-hmm. There's a perception out there among some people that we are actually losing wetland acres in totality in the state of Minnesota. We can't be losing acres based on the fact that we have WACA, we have two-for-one replacements and so forth. We have a tremendous amount of money from different programs through your agency, that are restoring wetlands and through Legacy and these others. So is it possible that we are actually losing acres of wetlands in the state of Minnesota under the current rules and statutes?
Ms. Becker-Kadelka?
Madam Chair, Representative Fabian, our reports that we do, which is the parts of the wetlands that we have statutory authority to have accountability for, show that we have not lost wetlands.
So, in fact, are we gaining some acres then because of two-for-one on some of those programs?
Madam Chair, Representative, the impact, because the mitigation, oftentimes when you create a wetland, it doesn't have the same amount of environmental benefits as a natural wetland. It takes several years for that to develop. And so if there is gain on it, it would be a very, very minute percentage on it. But I can certainly look that up and see if there is if there has been wetland gain.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Why don't you proceed with your presentation? Thank you.
Madam Chair, members, the local road wetland replacement program is running out of credits right now. And so this has been an issue that's been in front of the legislature for many years. In order for us to do this and to take on the cost when local governments widen or repair a road, we need to have credits to do that. So we have a couple of areas in the state you'll see that are at zero credits right now. The legislature in the past has provided money through bonding and one-time money through general fund appropriations. Drainage is another area. It's in statute 103B that asks Bowser and gives Bowser the direction to facilitate a drainage work group. And this is a work group made up of agricultural interests, made up of environmental interests, local governments, folks that do this, drainage authorities that do this as part of their authorities. And so it's facilitating both the work group and a management team working on things like a public drainage manual to help provide guidelines for drainage authorities. And finally, buffers. So the 2015 law directed the agency to implement buffer legal implementation throughout the state. And the way that this was achieved was through local collaboration. And so this happened with soil and water conservation districts, watershed districts as drainage authorities, and counties, all working towards achieving implementation and compliance. Where are we at today? The percent compliance for public waters as of January 2019 reporting from the soil and water districts was at 99%. So 99% compliance. Back on the left-hand side of your slide, you'll see what it was in January of 2017, the first time that the districts took an inventory, to January of 2018, to January of 2019. We strongly commend the hard work of our local government partners and of landowners and farmers who have been really willing and diligent to figure out how to make this work, whether it be a buffer or an alternative practice to get the same effects of water quality. Then we move into conservation delivery, and this is really the meat of why Bowser exists. It's delivering land and water conservation programs and projects through our local government entities. Of our budget, over 85% goes out to our local government partners. And it's a range of the conservation continuum. So on one side, it's all about landowner choices. So on one side, it might be a landowner who's making decisions on his or her land, and they do not want any outside support. They don't want any technical assistance. There are some times where landowners are asking for technical assistance or maybe cost share. Sometimes there are short-term programs they might sign up for that are incentive-based, or all the way over to the right-hand side, perpetual land retirement. There's absolutely not one way that's better than the other. It's really about this continuum, and it's about landowner choice. So if we take that right-hand side of the continuum, voluntary resource protection. Right now in Minnesota, we have our big easement program is called the Minnesota CREP, the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program. And for those of you who have been on this committee will know that the legislature has directed the agency to implement this program and has put over $140 million towards it in order so that we can unlock a federal match that is around $350 million. And those dollars, that federal match of $350 million, all goes as direct payments to landowners. The CREP scope is 60,000 acres. It's voluntary. It's permanent. It's targeted only to those most environmentally sensitive areas. So it's just three practices. It's buffers, wetlands, and wellhead protection. To date, we've had over 12,000 acres enrolled in the program. We are on a hiatus right now from enrollments because of the federal government didn't have a farm bill in place as of September 30th, so we couldn't take any more enrollments there. And then there was the shutdown in late December and early January. And so now, as both of those things, there's a new farm bill, the government's up and running, and so now we expect to be hearing from the federal government very soon about how they want us to gear this up again and start the enrollment process. We move on to other key programs. So the Minnesota CREP, the Conservation Reserve Enhancement Program, focuses on several funding sources: Outdoor Heritage Fund, Clean Water Fund, LCCMR, and bonding. We also have specific competitive grants. So this moves us back down the continuum towards short-term protections. One thing to note here is that the need far outweighs the funding. And so this is something that we see out there, that conservation practices are something that are in far further demand than there is supply. Our local government partners have been at the forefront of leading. How do we then, knowing this, how do we then get the best public benefit out of these state resources? So in 2011, they met to start looking at where do we take geographic boundaries or geopolitical boundaries like a county or like a soil and water district and move that towards a watershed boundary. So really looking at where the water flows to make the decisions about what are the most prioritized and targeted areas to focus our work. This has resulted in one watershed, one plan, bringing local government entities together to form planning groups along watershed bases. In our Clean Water Fund, some of the implementation to date, there has been over 1,600 grants issued, over 7,000 conservation practices employed. There's a map there that you'll see dots, and that also corresponds to where the private land is, and so you'll see, again, this is a focus on private land areas. And then the question is, so what are the outcomes? What does this mean? So we can measure outcomes in a couple of different ways. What we've had the most success in, because it's been around the longest, are calculators to determine if you do this practice, how much sediment will you stop from going into the water? Or if you do this practice, how much phosphorus will you stop going into the water? And calculate those. So right now, annually, as a result of these 7,000 plus conservation practices, it's keeping over 168,000 tons of sediment out of rivers, lakes, and streams, and 178,000 pounds of phosphorus every year. So some examples. This is a program that received resources in Dakota County. And nitrate was a problem here. The Vermilion River interacts with groundwater and surface water quite a bit over in this part of Dakota County. And so their nitrate has been an impaired water in this area, like in the Hastings area, that has been affecting drinking water supplies. So the city received a $412,000 Clean Water Fund grant through the Vermilion River Watershed Joint Powers Organization and used this to construct a 3-acre wetland just this winter. They used it with Dakota County dollars. There was a highway reconstruction going on in Farmington, plus matching funds locally from the Joint Powers Organization in Dakota County. It's going to treat runoff from 2.1 square miles of ag land, and it's upstream of the most the highest concentration of nitrate, so it's taking a look at where can we prioritize these resources to make the biggest bang for the public benefit. It is estimated annually that this will remove 13,000 pounds of nitrate. Another example, a Clean Water Fund grant in Roseau County. There has been drainage ditches up there have been in existence for 100 plus years, And so this one is about County Ditch 8. And so when heavy rains would come, landowners would call up the Watershed District Administrator and say, these rains are scouring out the ditch. They're heavy rains. We're getting so much sediment going through the area. And so with a $147,000 clean water fund grant, there has been an estimated 275 tons of sediment that has come out of the turbidity-impaired Roseau River. And in fact, the district administrator, in a follow-up, said that this year they had some pretty good rainfalls, and everything drained off quite well. The flow was good, and the land has been sloped back so that there was not continued erosion. So those are implementation outcomes with numbers, but there's also implementation outcomes with figuring out how do we determine progress towards goal. And so while we've had these indicators around, these calculators around for a dozen years, something that has been more recent with clean water funds is how do we start looking at modeling to say here's what the goal is, and so data that the PCA has gathered, and here's how we try to make progress towards that goal. For example, Lake McCarran is a volume reduction in stormwater reuse area. And so they know that they need to reduce an estimated 115 pounds of phosphorus. Their project, it was, this is North Capital, it's bioretention projects, and it's also using reuse, water reuse, so it's irrigating a baseball diamond. This project contributes almost 40% towards the goal. So they know that this one project is getting them along the way. Another one, Serpent Lake. This is in the Crow Wing watershed. They received a $1.2 million targeted watershed grant and trying to reverse declining trends in water quality. So they have reduced phosphorus by 139 pounds annually. That's 40% of the current load. And that's significant because what they're saying now in the watershed is that this will meet the lake goals for phosphorus. Another one, Grand Marais. Grand Marais had a channel cut in the early 1900s. We needed to get water off the land. We need water to work for landowners if they're trying to have productive crops and farming. So a channel was built to get it to the Red River faster, the water faster. What was learned was that getting water to the river faster also means getting more sediment to the river faster. And so a $660,000 Clean Water Fund grant provided the impetus to start this and to get several other local and regional and state organizations to commit funding to channel restoration. So it was taking the channel back to a natural meander. Over 700 tons of sediment a year are now being put back into the natural meander so that they settle out before they get to the Red River. This one is getting 87% towards goal of this part of the river. St. James is trying to protect drinking water. It gets its water from six wells north of town, and so this was one where Reinvest in Minnesota, an easement program of 108 acres, are now put where those wells are in a vulnerable drinking water area. Moody Lake is in the Comfort Lake Forest Lake system. This was a $430,000 grant, and this was where there's been years and years of accumulated cattle manure from a former dairy operation has impacted this wetland. And so trying to figure out what's the best way to move forward and to make strides towards restoring Moody Lake and downstream waters. And so this grant started with a farmers cooperation, started to remove sediment, was restoring wetland plants. And right now, the phosphorus load to Moody Lake has been reduced by 60%. The Pollution Control Agency's role is also the data gathering role. They are looking at delistings. Some have happened in Worth Lake, for example. The Poplar River up in St. Louis County is on track to be delisted with these projects and practices that are being implemented. There's also targeting conservation, and so this is where when we talk about progress towards goal, how do we really have prioritized, targeted, and measurable results? And so you can see that sometimes a whole list of projects and practices, and there's these results to date, get us part of the way. So this is the list of projects and practices. We know that we have been impacting this watershed for 150 years, and one project or one grant will start us on the way, but certainly isn't necessarily the only solution. One grant doesn't do it all in this case. Finally, I'd like to end on the outcomes with watershed-based funding. And so, as we mentioned before, we've learned about calculators in the last 10 years, so how much sediment and phosphorus can we estimate. We've started to take modeling and to take the data of the Pollution Control Agency and take a look at what is it that the goal is, and what will these practices do to try to get us farther towards that goal. And One Watershed, One Plan is starting that process. The Yellow Medicine Watershed was one of the first partnerships, planning partnerships, that developed a One Watershed, One Plan program and received watershed-based funding. And so with their watershed-based funding, for example, they know that they have a 10-year goal of removing around 8,000 pounds of phosphorus. The current grant that they received, it was about $500,000, they can now target it to what are those areas that are most important, that are most prioritized to get the biggest reductions, and they know that with this grant, it will start them along their way. They're estimating that they will get 800 pounds of phosphorus removal, and so they have a 10-year goal to meet this 8,000 pounds. One thing that's important to remember is that it's really about scale, and that as these projects come in and as we're working towards them, sometimes the scale might be large. It might be a whole watershed basis. So we might see something that is 10% along the way, or we received a grant once for the St. Croix River watershed that said it was 1% along the way, because these are large basins. Other areas, like talking about one lake or one section of a stream, might get us closer towards progress towards goal. It's really about on-the-ground conservation and recognizing that these private lands require local involvement from the people that live and work in the watershed. We're learning more with One Watershed, One Plan. It's helping us to target, to prioritize, and then to measure what are the kinds of results that we've gotten. The Yellow Medicine County Commissioner may have said it best. He said, you have to think as a watershed and not just as I'm a part of this county or I'm a part of this district. The watershed isn't just isolated to our county, and as projects are being done upstream, it's ultimately going to help us downstream. And so, for example, in this case, his county may not have gotten most of the dollars or the resources for the One Watershed, One Plan grant, but because they knew by putting it upstream it would benefit their county, they now have a better planning process in place. And then finally, to wrap up the agency's overview, we are also charged in the Disaster Recovery Assistance Program to help local governments and private landowners when disaster strikes. It's the purpose to provide designated emergency appropriations to our local government partners in disaster areas, and oftentimes it's through our soil and water conservation districts. And so we recognize that our local government partners need information to navigate through disasters, that landowners need information to navigate through disasters, and that since we don't know when they're coming, this is one of those quick responses that we must have. So finally, we're in the business of figuring out ways to be efficient, effective, to work with landowners, and to find ways to keep Minnesota working towards that commitment of productive and healthy soils and clean water. And Madam Chair, I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you. We do have a few questions. Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. One word. I don't know if it's a question or an observation, but when you're talking about progress toward goal, and I'm looking on page 17 about the safeguarding St. James's drinking water, and you talk about the 108 acres, that sounds great, but I don't know what your goal is here. There are 400,000 acres of land that needs to be protected to protect Minnesota's drinking water wells that have, and that's not all of them. Those are just the ones that the Department of Health has figured out. So they're, so what's the progress, what's the goal here? So what's the goal, and how 108, I mean, is this a 1,000-year goal? I don't understand.
Madam Chair, Representative Wagenius, it's a really good question, and this is a protectionary goal. And so this is in a vulnerable drinking water area, and there are 6 wells that are north of St. James. And so what the local governments and the city were looking together at, how can we take an immediate impact to where those groundwater draws are coming from and make sure that there are no more nitrates or fertilizers or pesticides that might sink into the ground. And so the best way to do that, they determined what the acreage might be around to protect those wells. Now, you're exactly right that there's plenty more areas to go in areas that are vulnerable and highly vulnerable. This is an example of one that was looking at a protectionary aspect, and not a restoration one.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you. Well, if I could follow up, the goal should be not just helping St. James, it should be helping all the communities in the state. So that the goal should be 400,000 acres minimum. So what is your plan to reach the goal for the state? Do you have a plan?
Ms. Baker-Kudelka.
Madam Chair, Representative, so as you know, the challenges are all complexly wrapped up in the money that were appropriated by the legislature, how we're directed to use that money, and what are the private land conservation decisions that landowners want to make. We've been working with several partners, including the Department of Health and Rural Water and the Department of Natural Resources and Ag, to talk about how do we take that large number of acres and really try to prioritize it to the most critical ones. And so which of those 400,000 acres are being cropped right now as opposed to being in pasture? Which of those 400,000 acres are in vulnerable and highly vulnerable areas? And so trying to take a look at and what are the things that the cities and the counties can do. And so one of the pieces with this group is we are taking a look right now at how do we take the resources that we have and prioritize them to considering all of those factors.
Representative Wagenius.
Well, but the department has already figured out how much is vulnerable or highly vulnerable. So now you're saying, no, we're not going to do the highly vulnerable. We're going to prioritize. We'll prioritize if they're row crops. If I remember correctly, that's 110,000 acres. So you've done 1% in the St. James. So I think we need to give people context when you're talking about goals. So without context, I don't know what any of this means. I mean, it's a great phrase, progress toward goals, self-life, a great phrase. But if we don't know what the goal is and we don't know what the context is, we don't know anything. So I saw another example, and I'm sorry I was late to committee. We were working on another bill, but I just turned the next page, and on 19, you're talking about yellow medicine and making progress toward goal, but in your yellow medicine, you're not looking at groundwater. You're only looking at surface water. So that means you're not looking at drinking water. So you're, again, you need to tell us what your goals are. So in yellow medicine, it wasn't a goal to protect groundwater or drinking water. It was just a goal to protect surface water. So again, the context of the phrase, if you use that phrase, we need to hear the context or we don't know anything.
Ms. Becker-Kudelka?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the comments. We would be glad to share with you the, and maybe you've already read it, the Yellow Medicine Watershed One Plan. It does talk about drinking water and what are the 10-year goals and how do we start to get there. And the local government partnerships have used factors and criteria, including where do they think they can make the biggest difference, what are the highest priority areas that the modelings are calling for, what's the current information that we have, and what are the resources that they have available. And so you're right that there are lots of things that are going to take a long time to fix.
Representative Guineas?
Thank you. Just as a final comment here, there is no atlas for the Yellow Medicine area. So you can't even talk about drinking water if you don't know what your groundwater is like. So I did hear a presentation on Yellow Medicine, and I was stunned that you spent $750,000 on a plan and did not know anything about your groundwater because there was no atlas done. And that's kind of the first step in understanding groundwater. So again, context is critical for us. What is your goal here? And not knowing the context doesn't tell me anything.
Ms. Becker-Kudelka?
Thank you for your comments. And we'd be glad to sit down with you after this as well with the local government partners to talk about how they've prioritized their goals and how they're looking at it with the information that we have, knowing that there's lots of priorities out there in that watershed. And the legislature has not yet appropriated resources for groundwater atlas in that area. And so knowing that, we'd be glad to sit down and talk with you about the data that they have. And then also, how did they make priorities from that data?
Thank you. Representative Heintzman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just this conversation has raised a few thoughts as Representative Guineas is going along. And as a former watershed district manager underneath of Bowser, I'm just wondering if the assistant director could explain how your mission or what your organization, what Bowser's responsibility is in terms of a top-down approach, or as like when I was a watershed district manager, there was a lot of reaching out from the agency to try to find out what our goals were. And I don't recall there being a set list of goals that you folks were trying to run into our agency. I thought that there was a lot more of a local approach to that. Am I mistaken? Maybe the assistant commissioner could, or the director could explain that.
Ms. Becker-Kudelka?
Madam Chair, Representative, thank you for the question. The watershed districts and soil and water conservation districts are created as special purpose units of local government. So this means that they are autonomous organizations. They elect their own boards in the case of SWCDs. They appoint board members in the case of watershed districts via the counties. And so the agency's approach is really that conservation must be locally driven. And one of the challenges has been figuring out how do we help support and getting more prioritized in that work. And so with the Clean Water Fund dollars, for example, has been a process where local officials will get together and work on not only what are the priorities, but how can we use more data and modeling to help inform what a particular watershed district or county can do.
Representative Heisman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So just to Representative Guineas's comments, you know, I would add my own that I would hope that we continue to work with those local folks as opposed to telling them here's what you're going to be doing going forward. I hope that there would be a continued effort to better understand those specific issues in those districts, because they're different all over the state. And I hope that diverse thought continues to be a big focus at the agency level as opposed to handing down a directive and saying, this is what you're going to be doing going forward. And I know that one watershed, one plan can sound to some extent. And when I first began learning and reading some of what was there, I was concerned that we would lose that local control at that level. But it does appear that there's still some flexibility there, and I hope it stays. If there's any comments, that's fine. Otherwise, that's my concern.
Thank you. Assistant Director Becker Kudelka.
Madam Chair, Representative, and you're absolutely right. It's local. It's a locally driven process. Using also the state needs to be a resource to these groups, and that's how Minnesota has approached its conservation delivery on private lands to determine what are the best way to take in all of those factors and all of those criteria.
Representative Wagenius.
Since you brought up my name in this, I wasn't going to comment again, but in my own watershed district, which is Minnehaha Watershed District, the goal was to get water apparently, well, one of the stated goals was to have enough water going over Minnehaha Falls. And not looking or not incorporating science that telling us we're going to have great big rain events. And so now, with having a limited goal and no science, we're having flooding problems. And so one of the pieces of the puzzle here, it seems to me that the state could provide more science that needs to be incorporated into local decision making.
Assistant Director Becker-Kudelka, do you have any closing remarks?
No,
or
thank
responses?
You.
Thank you very much. And I apologize for neglecting to use your title. Thank you very much for coming, Assistant Director Becker-Kudelka. All right. Representative Hewitt, you're here. Representative Hewitt, I move that House File 609 be laid over for future consideration. Representative Hewitt, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members. This bill is best told with a story from my door knocking experience this last fall, and then I'm going to turn it over to Commissioner Atkins here to tell you what the real need, what the weeds are. Last fall, I was knocking a few doors, and I came up to one that a family came out, and they're moving to the area because of our values here in Minnesota are to make our trails accessible for all. And I thought that was really neat how they told me how they went way up north, and they were able to use those trails and down to the Cannon Valley and use those. But the trail that was in Rosemount was beautiful. It was along the Mississippi River, and all of a sudden, it came to a screaming stop. And one of the children are in a wheelchair, and their options were to continue the trail a mile down the road, either by going down a gravel road, which is a place where they haul a lot of trucks are hauling goods, or go out to Highway 55 and follow alongside the road. We really don't want this. We need to do better, and I'm asking for a simple ask here to continue this project that the state and us have started already, and I'm going to let Commissioner Atkins take it from here.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
I'm Joe Atkins. I'm a Dakota County Commissioner. And Madam Chair, members, thank you very much for having me. I can, as a former member, I can tell you, by the way, that if you try using your ID to get into the member parking ramp after you retire, it doesn't work anymore. Just ahead, I didn't really try that. I'm in the public parking, but it's nice to see everybody. I first want to start by thanking Representative Hewitt for providing or authoring this bill and for this committee for hearing this bill. As much as I'd like to say this is all about environmental concerns, because I know what committee I'm in front of, The bottom line, folks, is it's really about public safety. This is a stretch that goes, as you know, Mississippi River Trail, designed to go all the way from Itasca to the Gulf of Mexico. It's a magnificent trail. We're down to the final mile and a half in Dakota County, and it is dangerous. It genuinely is dangerous. We now connect to Ramsey County. We connect all the way down to Representative Juergens' district down in Hastings, with the exception of one gap that goes through Representative Hewitt's district. It just happens to be, and in fact, I told a similar story this morning. I was on this trail. Last time I was on it, I followed a young family, mom, dad, three little kids on bikes. And as they were going down through this stretch, you can actually traverse through it. It's on a gravel road. Gravel road in and of itself ain't so bad, right? Like gravel roads. It's gravel roads that's kind of peaked, and on one side, there's heavy truck traffic that comes up out of an industrial area, and on the other side, there's an active rail line. Not exactly where we want to put our 200,000-plus users of the Mississippi River Trail running through this stretch of Dakota County. So we're here today to ask for your help in plugging that gap. It's an unsafe gap. It's one that we're virtually there relative to design. We think we can do it in a safe fashion. We have made, you have made, the local taxpayers have made, and the federal government has made a significant investment in completing this trail, but we've got this one last gap. It's part of our you'll see later in session, we've got a larger proposal, to plug various gaps within the Dakota. We've got a wonderful trail system, but we've got a lot of spots where you just come into conflict with trucks and cars, and in this case, trains. Not a good thing for pedestrians and cyclists to be doing, particularly when you're in the third largest county in the state. We have a lot of growth, and we're losing our opportunities. With every day that goes by, we're losing our opportunity to find safe places to put these trails that do not require eminent domain, do not require us to invade upon residential properties or business properties. So that's our ask today, and with that, Madam Chair and members, again, thank you very much for the support that you've offered in the past, and we'd appreciate your support for this bill and for our future project.
Thank you. Are there any questions from committee members? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Adkins, congratulations on your promotion.
It improved both bodies. Madam Chair, I'm sorry.
Did you say one last gasp or one last gap? I'm not sure. No, I'm kidding. So to both of the testifiers, what is the local match in this project?
Commissioner Adkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Fabian. First off, we've already invested millions getting to this point. The last estimate that I saw was in excess of $6 million. This is an ask for $2.5 million. And so we're hopeful. We don't have the bids. Obviously, we don't have the bids at this point, but there's a significant local match from Dakota County.
Representative Fabian.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. So significant is that relative to Northwest Minnesota significance or Dakota County significance? What's the definition here?
Commissioner Adkins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, Representative Fabian, I anticipate that whatever is not provided by this body will be made up. I just don't want to mislead the committee because we don't have bids yet. And depending on how those bids come in, but the last estimate that we saw was in excess of $6 million to complete this final stretch.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right. Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against this bill? All right. I renew my motion that House File 609 be laid over for future consideration. The bill is laid over.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
Representative Lissagard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a very special guest, Tyler Jacobson, who is an eighth grader at Mesabi East, and he lives in Biwabik. So you can indulge me. He's going to participate while I go through this process.
Welcome. I will move your bill, House File 320, to be laid over for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. And Representative Lissagard, you have an author's amendment?
Correct.
Does everyone have a copy of that? Representative Lissagard, please speak to your amendment.
Okay. Well, the amendment is to the first one-time money. It's not ongoing. So.
All right. Well, I move the A1 amendment. is the number, right? To get the bill in the shape of the author would like. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Lislegarde, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, this bill basically appropriates $950,000 for the next 2 years, 2020 and 2021, for a total of $1.9 million from the ATV account to the DNR for grants for the Quad City ATV Club. And this is for trail planning, design, environmental permitting, the right-of-way acquisition, and trail construction. And the whole goal of this is to connect all the different trails and to make this a destination for the whole region. So as we heard from Representative Holt in Mississippi, well, we truly are in God's country, and Representative Fabian can attest to that. And so I just think that it's a really good bill, and today we have three testifiers. If you'd indulge me, we have David, the president of the Quad Cities ATV Club, to also testify.
Thank you. As your testifiers have come up. And please introduce yourselves for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representatives. David Dinko, I'm president of Quad Cities ATV out of Virginia, Minnesota. We're here today looking at this bill for trail development, connectivity. One of the big things we have in our area is we have the OHV park, which is the biggest in the state of Minnesota, which is expanding this year. The problem with that is there's no connection to it except for the city of Gilbert right now. As of 2 years ago, our club just started. We're 500 plus members strong right now. And our goal was none of our local cities had ordinances for ATVs. And in the last 2 years, all of our cities have ordinances. All of our members or our mayors, our commissioners, they all want to see this come to our area. They want to be one of the main hubs for ATV in Minnesota. So right now we have a lot of trails that are, you know, within 7 to 10 to 12 miles from us, but there's no connection. So this is what we're looking to do.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee members? Do you have other testifiers?
Yes. Yes, I do. Ron.
Hello, and please introduce yourself for the record.
Madam Chair, committee, my name is Ron Potter. I've been working with the Quad City and several of the other clubs up in this part of the country trying to create this trail system. And I believe there's a map in your packet that kind of lays out what this proposal is for. But it will take the Quad Cities of Virginia, Eveleth, Gilbert, and Mountain Iron and connect them not only, as Dave said, to the Gilbert State Recreation Area, but also continue further to the east, connect to the Boabic Aurora existing trail as you go north. Out of Virginia, it will connect to the Taconite Trail, and the state is in the process of opening that up from where it connects on Highway 53 over to Side Lake and connect to the Chisholm Trail that's over there. On your map, as it continues north up to Highway 1, it'll connect with the Voyager ATV system, which is about a 500-mile system that runs from that area up to Crane Lake and eventually to International Falls. And then the leg that going off to the east, that will connect to the Prospector Trail system, and that connects the communities of Ely, Babbitt, Tower Sedan, and Embarrass, and also over to the North Shore, connecting to Lake County Regional Trail, which will also connect in Silver Bay and Two Harbors and up to Grand Marais. So this is an important part of a growing system, and these Quad Cities provides the largest city in this whole system, and provide some great opportunities for lodging, restaurants, and connection to services. So I ask that you please support this bill. It's very important to what we're trying to accomplish up in the Arrowhead as we try to expand the ATV trail system. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Potter. Representative Sundin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To any of the testifiers or the author, I'm not real familiar with ATV trails. I'm very familiar with the snowmobile trails. I'm just wondering, are all these trails interconnected, and are they usable for snowmobiles and ATVs?
Mr. Potter, Representative.
Madam Chair, Representative, we will be using some snowmobile trails. A lot of these are new routes that we will be building, and they will be opposite season. We are not proposing to have ATVs on snowmobile trails. It'll be summer use only.
Thank you, Madam Chair, if I may. I didn't mean to start a turf war between snowmobiles and four-wheelers, but the reason I ask is I was on a snowmobile trails, and some of those bridges are fairly narrow, and with the ATV uses expanding in their girth of the machines with the side-by-sides, which are a lot of fun, too, are you proposing using those same trails and maybe widening those bridges, or are they wide enough now?
Mr. Potter?
Madam Chair, Representative, on the snowmobile trails, those existing bridges are plenty wide. Our normal two-way trail is probably 8 to 10 feet, and the snowmobile trails in many cases are 12 to 20 feet wide. So, I mean, they're considerably wider than what we're looking for. State law, ATV side-by-side, 64 inches is the maximum width that they can be right now. So we know that they make larger ones, but that's not what we are building trails for at this time.
Thank you.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from the committee? Representative Lewick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can we go over again? I'm not sure who can answer the question. Where is this money coming from? In other words, we can't print money. Who actually put this into the state's treasury, so to speak?
Representative Lissikar?
Yeah, my understanding is that it is coming out of the ATV account into the DNR.
Representative Lewis.
Which got put in there by the folks that pay the license tabs on ATVs.
Representative Lissikar?
Yes, there is one more testifier.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Raymond Bowen. I am the representative lobbyist for the All-Terrain Vehicle Association of Minnesota, and I just want to say that we wholly endorse this project. A number of years ago, and I can't count back that far, Representative Rukavina approached us about putting together a recreational area in the Iron Range, and one of the things that was part of that vision was to create the recreation area is kind of the jumping off point to go up the range different ways to really make it a destination area where people come up and spend not just one day, but spend two or three or four days in that area. And this really, as you heard Ron talk about how it's going to be interconnected, is really the culmination of that. So we would very much appreciate your support and fulfilling Representative Rukavina's vision on this. And it's finally coming to fruition, and we're very happy about that.
Thank you. Are there any other questions from the committee? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lissikar, thanks for bringing this forward. I'm a strong supporter of ATVs. You know that, and Mr. Potter, the work that you've done in ATVAM, Minnesota. We need to continue to spread the good word about what a great machine ATVs are nowadays. We had a conversation last week about some ATVs, and I think there's still a perception out there that ATVs are something that they are not. And we need to continue to spread the good word about ATVs and the manufacturers right here in the state of Minnesota that make some incredible machines that grandmas and grandpas love to ride around on with their grandchildren. And I look forward to supporting you on this, and I hope that you will support me in my endeavors.
Thank you, Representative Lissikar. Any comments?
Just in closing, I mean, you know, the Iron Range, we're very proud of our rich history in mining and natural resources, but this really has grown to a new level that I think that it's really important that we embrace and we invest and we diversify, giving opportunity for people all across the state to come up and enjoy the wonderful and the beauty that we have up there. So I truly appreciate all that. And Representative Fabian, I did ask Tyler if he played hockey, and he said yes. And I said, "Do you ever play Rozo?" And he said, "Yes." And I said, "Did you win?" He said, "No."
Thank you. Are there any folks in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Representative Fabian.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Listlegard, maybe we can work on getting Representative Sundin up there to actually ride on one of our machines.
For sure. Thank you.
I renew my motion that House File 320, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. That bill is laid over. Representative Lee. I move a House File 600 be laid over for a possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. Representative Lee, I believe you have an author's amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, I do.
Would you like to speak and move your amendments?
So, yes, Madam Chair, I move the A3 amendment. The amendment changes the effective year from 2018 to 2019.
Representative Lee moves the A3 amendment to get the bill in the shape he'd like. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? The amendment is adopted. Representative Lee, please present your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. House File 600 makes a change to the disposition of fees collected by the DNR for deer hunting licenses. And I do want to note that the with the A3 amendment, when we requested a fiscal note, the note has said that if the bill was passed after March 1st, 2019, there may be a need to or an amendment to change the effective date to July 1st, 2019 to avoid a fiscal year 19 impact, but the amendment can be done closer to a date if needed, and I've been in conversation with the chair, and I think that that's a discussion that we are going to be having. So, to the bill, in 2017, the annual fee for adult deer licenses was increased from $28 to $34. At that time, the hunters agreed to support the fee increase with the understanding that the DNR was to dedicate much of this revenue to the deer management account rather than the General Fish and Wildlife Trust Fund. In 2018, a similar bill to this was introduced and passed as a part of the omnibus bill, but was ultimately vetoed. So this bill, House File 600, follows through on that agreement with the deer hunters. This bill will increase the amount of money from each resident and non-resident adult deer hunting license sold that is deposited in the deer management account from $2 to $16. And with me today is Corey Bennett from the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association and Yang Moore, a community member who has brought this issue to my attention too, to talk about the importance of transparency and openness when it comes to the how the deer license fee is used. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Bennett, please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, Corey Bennett, representing the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association. I want to thank Representative Lee for bringing this issue forward and this bill forward. Actually, as Representative Lee indicated, this was a carryover bill from last year. The legislature, and thank you, did have this in their versions that passed off the House and Senate floor. Unfortunately, like many other things, it fell by the wayside, and we're bringing it back this year. As Representative Lee had mentioned, this is an issue that kind of goes back to 2017. At that time, the DNR had proposed a fee increase for both fish and wildlife or big game types of licenses. And typically, the Minnesota Deer Hunters Association has always typically been in favor of those sorts of fee increases because we are very much want to make sure the fishing game fund stays solvent, and certainly a lot of those proceeds go to big game and deer management activities. One of the issues that we had when we brought this was brought to us in 2017 is that the Deer Hunters Association and the members that we represent wanted some more transparency. We've always been told by the Fish and Wildlife Oversight Committee that, you know, X amount of dollars always goes in. Don't worry about the numbers that are being that are in statute. We always are spending more, and we realize that as an association. But we wanted more transparency. We wanted to see some things down in statute so that we could have something tangible that our members could say, and that it was in statute, that X amount of dollars at a minimum would be spending for these activities. So as a result of negotiations with then-Commissioner Landwehr and the DNR, what you will see in your packets, you should have a letter stating the fact of, as far as that agreement goes. This bill lays out exactly how those proceeds would be dispersed. As was mentioned, instead of $2 going into the deer management account, there would be $16 that go into the deer management account. The $1 for the deer and deer management account would stay the same. The 50 cents that goes into the deer health or the cervid count, an emergency deer feeding count, would stay the same. And then the other major change is instead of $30 going into the general game and fish fund, $16.50 would go into the general game and fish fund. So with that, we support this bill. Thank you all for your efforts in the past and the future for bringing this forward, and I can stand for questions.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee members? Representative Lee, your other testifier.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The other testifier is Yang Moore.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Yes, thank you. My name is Yang Moore, and I'm a community member. Thank you for the representatives for inviting me here. I truly feel that the benefits of increasing the license sales and porting it into into this area here would be culturally, advancementally, and economically important and beneficial for the state of Minnesota. Conservation-wise, protecting the wildlife, trickling down to the ecosystem, food and habitat, as well as disease management, farming and food resources. When it's trickling down to the farmers, it's important that we also protect the farmers' lands as well as the resources that they do provide for their livelihoods, as well as the opportunity and the access for our past, present, and future recreational outdoors men, women, and children. Normally, Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, has about 500,000 license sales, and we have seen sort of a decrease in the license sales through the past decade. And I do see that there is a trend there also. But with the increase in providing better transparency to where these dollars are, it can help the new, present, future, past, and hunters, outdoorsmen, outdoorswomen, and outdoor enthusiasts to see where the money really is going, and to help provide more of a push for outdoor activity. So I just wanted to come here today and express how happy I am that Representative Fu Lee is pushing for this bill. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there other questions from the committee? Representative Becker-Finn.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm wondering if the DNR may be available. Specifically, I'm wondering if the DNR could speak to what the funds in the deer management account, what kind of programs and projects that money goes to.
Thank you. Please introduce yourself.
Madam Chair, members of the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Deer management account funds a variety of our activities, not only deer related. So there would be examples, our emergency deer feeding, when we do need to do that, this is where those dollars would come from. Also our area, local, regional wildlife staff that are working on deer issues. All of our funding from CWD currently are coming out of this account, or a lot of the funding is coming from that account. So anything that's deer related, our work touches everything. When we do habitat, as the testifier talked about, it's good deer habitats, not only good deer habitat, it's good grouse habitat. It provides habitat for a number of different species. So there's a lot of different tangential ecosystem benefits from that.
Thank you.
Any other questions from the committee? Is there anyone in the audience who would like to testify for or against the bill? Representative Lee, do you have any closing comments?
Just want to say thank you, Madam Chair, for the opportunity to present this, and thank you to committee members.
Thank you. I renew my motion that House File 600, as amended, be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill. The bill is laid over. Is there any further business? In our packets, there is a memo with the bill referrals to the Water Division. With that, we are adjourned.